You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. Egyptian voters went to the polls last week to ostensibly choose their next president. The results, as has been the case for most of Egypt's history, were already predetermined. Unsurprisingly, the current president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, will return to power by a wide margin. The official results say that he won with roughly 90% of the vote. These elections, of course, were neither free nor fair. The Egyptian strongman is not one to take chances. Since taking power in a coup in 2013, he's presided over the crushing of political dissent in a country that had just seen glimpses of freedom in the years after the 2011 Arab Spring. For now, al-Sisi will remain as president of Egypt, but the country he leads is mired in economic distress, and it's surrounded by regions in turmoil. In this episode, we're going to take a look back at al-Sisi's 10 years as ruler of Egypt and address the question of how exactly one man has dominated this country, its institutions, and its people for over a decade. We'll explore the methods through which he's remained in power, how he's transformed Egypt's economy and politics, and what the future holds for this new pharaoh and the 110 million people over which he rules. Our guide today is Hesham Salam, who is the Associate Director for Research at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at Stanford University. He's an expert on Egypt's politics. Hesham, thank you for joining us. It's been a long time.
Thank you, Arif. Great to be with you.
So just to let our listeners know, Hesham and I went to grad school together. We haven't spoken for some time, but this show is a reunion of sorts. So, Hesham, let's start by talking about the mechanics of these elections. In 2014 and 2018, Sisi won 97% of the vote. This time around, he's won a slightly smaller share, just around 90%. Now, when you look at Egypt, it's a big country. Egyptians are proud people. They have strong opinions. I think anybody who's spoken with, you know, people in Egypt can kind of attest to that. So it takes a lot to ensure this kind of result. And for me, the story is not the elections per se, but how authoritarianism works in Egypt today under al-Sisi. So I'd like you to talk to us about how the regime shapes the political environment to ensure an electoral outcome that is so overwhelmingly and unbelievably in its favor and guarantees these absurd results. How exactly does it do that?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, Arif. And this is such a great and pleasant reunion, as you said. But to your question, I think you're absolutely right that the most recent presidential elections, they're a non-event to the extent that the winner has been predetermined and known in advance. And challengers have even been handpicked by the regime to ensure that the election campaign season won't turn into a platform for criticizing the Sisi administration and or riling up popular anger against it. One thing to keep in mind here is that this regime is very different from its predecessors in that it doesn't put as much weight on the value of, for lack of a better term, the facade of democracy per the rule, for example, of Hosni Mubarak. Both regimes are authoritarian, and under Mubarak, we all knew the president was going to rule indefinitely. But the difference is that the government under Mubarak showed some willingness to cut parliament some slack, to allow for some competition during election seasons, and to allow for some criticism of the government in the media. That way of doing business was completely decimated under Sisi. The regime became more closed, more authoritarian, more personalist, less tolerant of dissent, and also less inclined to delegate powers to nominally elected institutions, even to the most limited degree. So we're talking about a regime that has very low tolerance to any form of uncertainty in politics, especially in electoral politics. And this is the context in which the election is taking place. That said, even if the election is not competitive or is not nearly as competitive as elections were under Mubarak, and even if they don't really leave room for meaningful political competition, I think the vote here is significant in other ways, especially this presidential election, the 2023 presidential election. For example, I think the election is important is that it will likely shape how the regime will structure its political apparatus in the coming years. Of great importance will be the role of its de facto or informal political arm known as Mustaqbal Watan Party, or this is Arabic for a nation's future party. And that it's a party that was founded by the intelligence agencies shortly after the coup to create a pro-youth movement that's capable of building popular support for Sisi. That didn't work out as planned for, but to make a long story short, after the 2018 election, the party began undergoing an internal transformation that turned it into this hub for the usual suspects of Mubarak-era politics and the networks that supported Mubarak's ruling party, the National Democratic Party. And that happened because Sisi began realizing that he needed the support of the traditional political classes, even though he had been trying to evade them for years out of fear that they could gain too much power at his own expense, as was the case during Mubarak's final decade in office. So he was fearful of that Mubarak scenario playing out once again. At any rate, since that turning point in 2018, the party has taken on responsibilities that one would associate with a ruling party. Except it was never recognized officially as a ruling party, even though it held the majority of the seats in parliament, even though the regime has clearly been using the party as its own mouthpiece. And that lack of recognition can be explained in large part by the fact that Sisi's personalist tendencies seem to always manage to carry the day, and the regime seems to be resisting that type of institutionalization. It doesn't want to rely on a political party. It doesn't want to rely on the traditional political elites, or it doesn't want to rely on any mediation between the, you know, Sisi himself, the President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and his supporters. The regime really operates on the basis of a very personalist, populist strategy in advancing its own agenda. Now, fast forward to our current moment, to 2023. Mustaqbal Watan has basically been leading the effort to mobilize voters and supporters on behalf of the regime. And that is telling us that they're really using this occasion, the occasion of the election, to prove that they are worthy of being Sisi's ruling party. Whether or not they've succeeded, you know, remains to be seen. But the key point here is that the election itself has become the equivalent of what I would call, you know, for lack of a better term, an employee performance appraisal for the regime. It's an opportunity for the allies and the interlocutors of the regime to prove their usefulness and worth to the president in the hope of getting promoted and politically elevated down the line. And it's not just Mustaqbal Watan that is playing this game. You know, one of the challengers who ran against Sisi is Hazem Omar, the leader of the Republican People's Party, which is another pro-Sisi party that's been vying for the regime's support and has been trying to play a prominent role in the political theatrics that the government has been erecting over the last couple of years. And Hazem Omar, who finished second with 4.5% in this election, he himself has been a political cheerleader for Sisi for years. But, you know, like many other political allies of the regime, he's trying to use this election to as an opportunity to step up to the plate, play the role of the pretend challengers in the election gracefully and effectively and convincingly, in the hope that his party will end up getting from Sisi a more prominent role in state-managed politics, possibly as the regime's loyal opposition, or maybe more aptly, as the regime's pretend opposition. So the election is not really a competition for votes. This is what we're learning. It's really a competition for political roles inside Sisi's political apparatus. It's not advancing political openness or participation in any shape or form. It's simply, you know, or at least the main significance of it is that, or one of the main significances of it is that it's shaping the internal workings of the regime.
So this is kind of, you know, an audition in some ways for their various actors to demonstrate their utility to the paramount figure in this patrimonial system, the Fatah Sisi. And so while, you know, there are people that are going out to the ballot box and exercising what is ostensibly their choice, the part of the show is, you know, the individual actors and networks that are getting these people out and proving their efficacy to the man who's actually in power. Now, I'm wondering, just in terms of the mechanics of the electoral exercise, you know, some say that many votes are bought, or we have working class Egyptians are given food to turn out for elections. And then we also have viable candidates, people that actually have posed as Sisi and also have a substantial base in the country or support base in the country, are pushed out of the electoral process or disqualified or imprisoned or threatened. So I'd like you to talk about how that stage is set for getting this 90% that we've seen today and the 90%, 97% that we saw in the two previous elections. What does the state do to get those crazy numbers?
I mean, I'll start with your last point, and your last point being the fact that all the candidates have been handpicked by the regime. That was the case in 2018, competitive, and was the case in 2023. And what happened in both elections is that any threatening alternatives were eliminated through a process of intimidation, through a process of bullying, through fraudulent tactics, legal maneuvers, electoral engineering. In 2023, one of the important things that happens is that, you know, there was a moment in time when what was described by many observers as a viable challenger to Sisi emerged. Ahmad Tantawi, you know, a Nasserist politician who is a leader inside of Al Karama Party, one of the longstanding Nasserist parties in Egypt. And one of the things that the regime did very clearly and was fairly open in its intimidation of Tantawi's campaign, Tantawi's family members, people in his own networks, in order to push him or bully him out of the race. And ultimately, when none of that was actually working and Tantawi was still sort of seemingly intent on running in this election, what they eventually did is that they just made it nearly impossible for his campaign to fulfill the requirements needed in order for Tantawi to get his name on the ballot. And they did so by, you know, there were either two paths towards gaining candidacy in the or qualifying for candidacy in the presidential elections. One of them is actually getting a certain number of endorsements from sitting members of parliament. And that was not a viable option for Tantawi. Simply did not have the alliances or the coalitions in parliament to be able to do so. And so the only viable path for him was to gather, you know, endorsements, popular endorsements, signatures from voters, registered voters, in order for him to qualify getting on the ballot. And what the regime did is that it made it, you know, it put all sorts of bureaucratic hurdles in front of his supporters in order to prevent them from registering these endorsements. And it made it impossible for his campaign to be able to gather the necessary signatures to make this happen. And eventually Tantawi announced that he would not be running and, you know, conceded that there were just too many obstacles in his way to be able to make this happen. So, you know, in 2018, there was much more, I would say, oppressive process by which the regime was able to eliminate its challengers from the presidential race. You know, there were two viable candidates or two fairly threatening candidates from the perspective of Sisi, including former Army Chief of Staff Sami Anan and former Air Force General and Mubarak's last Prime Minister Ahmed Shafi, And, you know, in the case of Sami Anan, he was basically detained under politically motivated reasons and was basically kept behind bars for a little over a year and was prevented from running in the race. And then a variety of intimidation and bullying tactics were used to push Ahmed Shafi to announce that he would not be running in this race and to backtrack on his announcement that he intends to run in the election. And I think this sent a fairly chilling effect inside the political community and sent the message that running against Sisi, especially for competitive candidates who are coming from within the state, especially competitive candidates who are coming from within the system, from within the security sector, it's going to be a very tall order for them to be able to run. We didn't find candidates of that profile coming to the fore in the lead up to the 2023 vote. You did have someone who seemingly had a lot of popularity, or at least a fair amount of popularity, to create, you know, a political spectacle that threatened the regime, which is Ahmed Tantawi, and they made it nearly impossible, made it completely impossible for him to run in this election. But I would say, you know, because the election is not featuring any competitive or any threatening candidates from the perspective of the regime, the focus really is on the question of turnout rates and the question of the spectacle of participation. You know, the regime has invested a great deal of resources and energy to produce the facade of large-scale participation in the vote. The official turnout figure, which is 66%, is very suspect, and it's not consistent with what reporters have been seeing on the ground during the voting days. There've also been observations that, you know, state employees and employees of state-affiliated organizations and subsidiary organizations have been bused en masse to vote. There have been a lot of reports of vote buying, and this is extremely significant because the economic situation in Egypt has been deteriorating, and clearly the regime has been capitalizing on this in order to mobilize people or buy people's political support or buy them into voting for in this election. I don't necessarily think that this was a campaign to rig the vote in favor of Sisi, because the vote was already rigged before any ballots were cast. The vote was rigged by virtue of the exclusion of competitive candidates from the process. So the focus really and the name of the game was the turnout rate. And I think on this point, and returning to this question of the workings of the political apparatus, I think this is one of the key differences between the 2018 and the 2023 elections, or more generally, the 2023 election and the two preceding presidential elections, the elections of 2018 and 2014, which is the fact that today the regime has a much more sophisticated political apparatus. It's since 2018, it has worked to actually incorporate a lot of political notables and a lot of networks, clientelistic networks that were working on behalf of the Mubarak regimes and political families that were once allied with the Mubarak regime. All of these people are now under the regime's tent, and the regime was definitely utilizing this in order to generate the spectacle of, you know, large-scale participation in the election. One of the really important things that journalists have observed, including my colleagues over at Madamas, arguably one of the few remaining independent media outlets in Egypt today, you know, one of the things that that their reporters have actually noticed is the phenomena of the non-moving lines, basically long queues of people in front of voting sites where this line is just there for the photo op. It's just there usually where the cameras are located, and they're just there for the photo op. And what is interesting to people is that these lines usually don't move. And when you talk to people at these lines, they'll often tell you that I'm just here
you know, I've been asked to actually stand here and I've been promised lunch, I've been promised something in return. And I think that that's one of the key differences between 2018 and 2023 is the large-scale investment in generating that spectacle of crowds at voting centers. And it's something that was very deliberately orchestrated in order to generate convincing narrative that validates that 66% figure, which, as I've mentioned, is very, very suspect. That is to say, there was a concerted effort on the part of the regime to demonstrate these unprecedented levels of political participation in order to send the message that the political process is viewed as legitimate, that the policies of the third Sisi administration are backed by an overwhelmingly large popular mandate. It's no secret that the government has committed itself to an IMF loan agreement with conditions that will likely push, you know, already skyrocketing prices to a level that will probably create a great deal of economic grievances and discontent. So the regime feels that it needs the legitimacy of this vote to advance what will be very unpopular measures, including but not limited to a new round of currency devaluations. And I think this is the broader context in which the election should be understood.
Yeah. And so the regime initially had put a considerable effort into demobilizing the politicized population. And now, you know, the lead up to these elections, or at least on election day, has the regime, as well as regime-aligned elements, have tried to mobilize the, you know, parts of the population for this spectacle, as you said, or this performative exercise in the elections, which are aimed at legitimizing the regime and signaling that it has some kind of popular consent. But obviously, the regime, as you'd said, is afraid of a truly competitive exercise. Egyptians, according to surveys, are deeply dissatisfied with the state of their economy. Inflation is at around 40%. This, you know, IMF program could push it higher because of, you know, the reduction of subsidies and things like that. And inflation, high inflation, has actually been a feature of the Assisi era. And nearly 30% of Egyptians live below the poverty line. So to retain hold on power, coercion is really key as well. You know, you've talked about the kind of administrative and legal measures that are used to sideline viable opponents, and then also the kind of political machinations that go on within this broader family of people that are aligned with the regime or the general contours of the regime. But I'm wondering, what I'd like you to do is unpack the system of coercion in present-day Egypt that has demobilized the, you know, the real opposition to the Assisi regime. So in this broader context, we had the Arab Spring. The Egyptian public demonstrated its ability to mass mobilize in a way that made the world watch what was happening in Tahrir Square. That came to an end 2 years later, and the Tahrir Square spectacle, if you want to call it a spectacle, not to diminish what was there, but it was a visual element as well. You know, that was a byproduct of the initial social media era, the emergence of Twitter and this networked, virtualized network that people had leveraged to mobilize in a fraying authoritarian regime. So, you know, that has been a challenge for Hosni Mubarak in his final months in power. And there was also, you know, private media that has emerged in Egypt. So I'd like you to talk about that system of coercion that has been in place in Egypt for the past decade or so under Assisi, and how that also ensures the status quo for him.
I think you're absolutely right that coercion is a really important part of this equation. And I would even argue that, you know, violence specifically is the primary background condition to everything that we've experienced by ways of state-managed politics since 2013.
you know, as you've mentioned, there was this era of relative political openness that followed Mubarak's downfall in 2011 and remained so until the July 3rd, 2013 military coup that paved the way to the rule of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And after those 2 years of relative political openness, you know, we embarked on this era in which political space in Egypt is heavily policed and heavily regulated. And the road to this, I think, began with violence. You know, I always say this, you know, in reference to your point about the years between 2011 and 2013 and that era of open, dynamic political contention, that era of relatively free expression that had been largely unprecedented in Egypt in the recent past. One of the most distinctive or memorable chants, I would say, that the protesters, the anti-Mubarak, the then turned into anti-military council protesters, you know, one of their major chants was, you know, at least I'll say it in Arabic and then I'll translate it, you know, Ali wa Ali wa Ali Sut. Raise your voice high, and whoever chants will not die. And I think that slogan sort of conveyed this notion that peaceful protesters had become so powerful and so untouchable that the regime's forces or the security forces would never dare shoot at them. And, you know, even if this perception wasn't entirely accurate, since state violence was, in fact, part and parcel of politics, you know, during that era, you know, the chant reflected the extent to which these notions of popular sovereignty were, you know, imposing their hegemony on society and capturing public imagination, and also giving activists this sense of confidence and invincibility. And I think that belief or that sense of confidence and invincibility was completely shattered in August 2013. That was the time when security forces massacred nearly 1,000 protesters in a violent ambush against pro-Muslim Brotherhood and pro-Mohamed Morsi, President Mohamed Morsi supporters. There were two major sit-ins in Rabaa al-Adawiyya and Nahda Square that were contesting the military coup that happened on July 3rd. And that massacre was really a critical step in solidifying that post-coup political order. I think it sent the message that large-scale protests would no longer be tolerated by the state. And I think that understanding or that message later on, you know, it was institutionalized in an anti-protest law, a law that was described by many international human rights organizations as a draconian anti-protest law that granted Egyptian authorities discretion in banning protests and clearing them by force. So I think the early use of violence in the life of this, in the early stages of this regime, you know, it was extremely important to understanding the current political moment in Egypt. But also, you know, the repression that followed, you know, we're talking about a decade of mass arrests, politically motivated prosecutions. It first started against the Muslim Brotherhood, its leaders, its members, its supporters, and then it expanded and were directed against, you know, the pro-revolution or pro-January 25th revolution youth movements that you were just describing a little earlier, including the members and leaders of the April 6th movement. So, you know, you entered an era in which the political space was being violently cleared by force, in some cases through deadly violence, in other cases people were just, you know, arrested en masse and in some cases given and handed prison, in some instances death sentences en masse. And I think this is one of the major steps that actually resulted in the complete closure or appropriation of
the public political space that had existed in Egypt before the Sisi era.
Yeah, and so as part of that coercive regime or that system of violence, Egypt also has roughly 60,000 political prisoners in the country today, according to some estimates. Thousands have died in prison, including the former president, Mohamed Morsi. And as part of that kind of system, 60 detention centers have been built over the past 11 years to house all these political prisoners. And so alongside the, you know, the administrative and legalistic measures that are used to demobilize a very hyper-politicized or a very politicized and young population, that there's also a strong element of brutality. But now, you know, I want to talk about the Assisi model of authoritarianism. Egypt's entire modern history, it has seen some degree, some authoritarian rule, including direct rule by the military. What I'm interested in is how different things are during this era compared to Hosni Mubarak in particular. And, you know, could one say that President Assisi has evolved a different model of authoritarianism, maybe an authoritarianism 4.0 or something like that, you can call it, in Egypt today? What are the defining characteristics of the Assisi's model of rule as compared to his predecessors?
I mean, besides the large-scale use of violence, deadly violence, repression, politically motivated prosecutions and imprisonment, I think one of the defining features of the Sisi regime is that rejection of the facade of democracy. And I think this is one of the important and key differences between the Sisi and the Mubarak regimes. The Sisi regime does not put a whole lot of weight on, you know, producing and generating that facade of democracy. And I think this is grounded in this belief that any political opening, however small, however limited, however targeted, could lead to an encore of the 2011 uprising, which is exactly the scenario that the security establishment of the Sisi regime has been trying to preempt for the past decade. And I think this narrative is informed by an understanding that views the beginning of the end for Mubarak as not January 2011 per se, but his pursuit of limited political liberalization during his final decade in office, which was, as you recall, Arif, for a good chunk of this time, we were actually in grad school together. The state was beginning to tolerate protests, criticism of the president at an unusually broad scale. And I think for many of the security-oriented leaders of the Sisi regime, I think they are still holding on to that belief that if it were not for the calculated risks that the Mubarak politicians undertook in the name of political liberalization, in the name of advancing that facade of democracy, the 2011 uprising would have never happened. And in the hopes of preempting such a scenario from happening again, Sisi's ruling establishment has remained committed to closing the political arena to any meaningful opposition. And, you know, I think, you know, besides beyond the question of targeting dissenting voices, for prosecuting any political dissidents, the restrictions on the media and on civil society were just as important. You know, authorities have taken steps several years ago to block websites of independent media outlets. There was a law that Sisi signed, you know, that basically gave authorities free rein to monitor and regulate private social media accounts with large following. And also there were a lot of anti-terrorism laws that emerged around 2017 that also gave the state free rein in regulating civil society and regulating the political community and clamping down on it. So, you know, I think one important element in the story
is what happens with the privately owned media outlets that used to provide space for political contention and political debate and political dissent under Mubarak. A lot of these outlets, or nearly all of these privately owned media outlets, be it in the print media, be it in audiovisual broadcast, they were all taken over by the security sector through proxy ownership. So, you know, that means that there isn't a whole lot of space in today's Egypt to present alternative points of views, to present an alternative interpretation of where the country is going. An alternative interpretation, I mean, since we're talking about the elections, an alternative interpretation of what this election means or how this election is being run, or to actually provide forums for credible challengers to emerge on the political scene and to present credible critiques of the current government. So, you know, in other words, Sisi completely demolished the political field and that field of vibrant civil society, or at least relatively vibrant civil society that he had inherited from the previous era.
Mm. So Sisi continues to be haunted to some degree by 2011 and his belief that the modest opening in the late Mubarak era led to his downfall. And then, as you've said, you know, a part of his response has been this system of surveillance and censorship, and then also the state, effective state appropriation of the partly free private media. And this has been done through proxies. And then also part of its response has been the militarization of governance and the economy in ways that are far greater than before in Egypt's history. So, for example, we've got military advisors that are appointed to each provincial governor. And then there has been a massive expansion in terms of the military's foothold and military-owned companies in the economy, including through the construction of this new administrative capital. So I'd like you to unpack how the military itself, as a kind of bureaucracy, as well as a big business, is really key to the Sisi regime in ways that are really different from his predecessors.
So more broadly, I think the central role that the military is playing in governance and in running the Egyptian state outside of the security sector, needs to be contextualized in what came before the 2013 military coup. Because as you recall, prior to 2013, during that transitional phase between 2011 and 2012, there was an inclination on the part of military leaders to try to actually experiment with other forms of governance that would ensure the military's interests and protect the military's political and economic privileges, but that it would do so from behind the scenes. And I think there was what I think could be usefully conceptualized as the civilian punching bag model. So a model where the hope was that, you know, you would have a competitive political field with relatively free elections, and where the hope is that the military would manage to cut deals with civilian politicians such that the civilian politicians are nominally governing and, you know, charged and tasked with managing state institutions when the military is really running the most central and most sensitive operations from behind the scenes, particularly when it comes to economic public policy, when it comes to defense policies, when it comes to national security. And I think ultimately that model, I think, ended up collapsing as evidenced by the coup of July 2013. And I think it paved the way for a new consensus among the military's leaders that they would actually need to be in the driver's seat in order to be able to actually make this viable and make this work or make politics work for them. And I think this was the context for the rise of this heavily militarized state under the rule of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. But also, I think the question of the economy is extremely important because the Sisi's reliance on the generals and the military bureaucracy for managing the economy and managing civilian parts of state institutions, you know, it speaks to his own distrust of the civilian bureaucracy and the private sector. You know, people in Sisi's position or with Sisi's background tend to see the civilian bureaucracy as slow, as ineffective, as full of obstructionism, in stark contrast to military institutions, you know, known for this command and control style of management that doesn't leave a lot of room for bureaucratic resistance and that allows for quick execution of projects, particularly when it comes to big mega projects that the Sisi administration has been trying to advance. And I think also when it comes to the question of the economy, I think Sisi has avoided, you know, forging alliances with big business along the lines of the Mubarak regime, or at least the final decade of the Mubarak regime. And that is because, you know, the military establishment, as you know, had long resented that cozy partnership that especially Mubarak's youngest son, Gamal, had established with big businesses under that banner of economic liberalization. And once again, you know, there's a story that's being formed here of, you know, that what went wrong understanding or what went wrong under Mubarak narrative, I think is kind of shaping or seems to have always shaped Sisi's policies and Sisi's approach to governance. And in this particular incidence, it kind of reinforced President Sisi's reluctance to cultivate alliances within the business classes, and therefore the military really had to be in the driver's seat. And accordingly, you saw the military getting tasked with these large-scale mega projects that also allowed Sisi to reward the military and to reward the generals for their political loyalty, and allows them to reap the benefits of the coup that happened in 2013. And certainly, I mean, I think that particular development kind of spoke to the shifts in the ruling coalition, where, you know, the Sisi regime has become the reflection of a political alliance that is very much grounded within the security establishment and has been extremely reluctant to actually build alliances with other important social forces in the economy, in civil society, within the political community. And therefore, the product of this has been this emphasis on handing off important projects, important endeavors, important governance responsibilities for the military. And obviously, this is how it started, but I think this process of militarization eventually took a life of its own. You know, the military eventually became very much involved in, you know, other important parts of Egyptian cultural life. They've become part of, or at least indirectly have left their mark on cultural production, the media, higher education, and other civilian spaces. And in many cases, they were tasked with overseeing civilian ministries and governance bodies, sometimes in official capacities, sometimes in unofficial, quote-unquote, advisory capacities. And that militarization, or that militarization of the state, became so pervasive that even the hiring and training of many parts of the civilian bureaucracy ended up falling into the purview of military officials. You know, there has been a great deal of reporting that's been happening this year by independent media outlets in Egypt that's pointing towards these training programs that are administered by military bodies that prospective civilian bureaucrats and prospective leaders in the civilian bureaucracy are supposed to undergo, trainings that are run by the military that has become a prerequisite for hiring inside of government bodies. So that is to say, you know, it's not just the economy, it's not just military's representation in the state through the office of the president, but I think there is a much more, or a much wider and much more pervasive process of militarization that's been happening inside of the Egyptian state.
So Assisi clearly isn't taking chances. And as you've outlined, he's really moving away from, let's say, the corporatist model of the Mubarak era. And this is the byproduct of the specter of 2011 that haunts him as well as those who are allied with him. But now I want to get into more of Assisi the man. You've hinted at sort of elements of his worldview, but what would you say is his ideology, if he has one? Does he have a grand vision for Egypt? Or is he ultimately someone who's merely concerned about staying in power and keeping undesirable forces out of the political process? Is it just entirely a negative agenda? Or is he motivated by some grand vision to build a new Egypt or personal ambition? What ultimately drives him?
A key element in Sisi's vision for the future of Egypt is very much grounded in a view that puts so much weight on the Gulf model. I think the president's obsession with the aesthetics of extravagant wealth, his fascination with, you know, the construction projects that evoke, you know, lavish, that evoke the image of wealth and lavish Gulf cities like Dubai, you know, is something that cannot be ignored, because this is clearly a model that Sisi has been aspiring to mimic. And this also explains why the president tends to put so much emphasis on large scale mega projects that, you know, produce these spectacular structures that are, you know, usually inaugurated and announced and unveiled in large ceremonies where he gets to talk about his own wisdom, talk about his own foresight. I think this is a key part of a story. I think Sisi's definitely driven by this fascination with the Gulf model and a commitment to try to mimic this for Egypt. But you also find, you know, a model that is not really appropriate for Egypt, because Egypt, you know, cannot afford the cost of emulating the Gulf model that Sisi admires so dearly. And I think this is a big part of why the state's economic public policies have come under heavy criticism in the last several years, because you find a presidency that has been very much committed to these large scale mega projects that are supposed to wow audiences domestically and internationally, and are supposed to display this spectacle of extravagant wealth and lavish projects, but without actually being able to foot the bill. And that has really pushed the country towards what? Towards more borrowing, towards, you know, having to resort to the IMF, and has put, you know, has actually put the state in a very difficult position where it's unable to actually pay the bills for these costly mega projects that it had committed to erecting years ago, especially during the earliest phases of the Sisi presidency. But also, I think you definitely find a commitment to this vision of building politics from scratch. I think Sisi is, or at least at the beginning of his rule, he operated under this assumption that politics could be created out of thin air, that you could get rid of everything that was inherited from the Mubarak era, and that you could build your own political community, and that it will work, that you could actually, you know, recruit a new generation of young politicians that you can socialize through all of these training programs. You can socialize them to embracing the military supremacy over politics and the economy. And eventually, this will allow you to have functioning politics that is led by this new generation of politicians who are ideologically committed to supporting an enlarged role for the military in governance and in managing the economy. That is to say, you know, he does have these large scale ambitions for political engineerings that have not necessarily worked. And I do think that the transition that happens in 2018, particularly the shift that happens inside of Mustaqbal Watan Party and the transformation that the party underwent and that turned it from this youth-led movement into basically a hub for the traditional political elites and the political families that were allied with the Mubarak regime, that actually spoke to the limitations of that vision of large-scale political engineering. And, you know, I think this also speaks to this notion that for many years, at least for the first 4 years of his rule, I think Sisi was driven by this strong resistance to institutionalization. He's definitely a leader who is very averse to the mediation of any political class or any political party or any political movement. He's very much left to his own devices. He seems to be driven by a strong interest in relying on his own populist appeal in order to stay in office, in order to build a political community. But at the same time, I think the limitations of that vision has pushed him towards making concessions, making compromises. And one of these compromises really is, you know, the expanded role that formal political parties have come to play in the political process, which is something that he definitely did not want to pursue in 2014, when he was clearly trying to avoid reliance on political parties or trying to avoid forging meaningful alliances with political parties. You definitely find that this has changed over time, and that change was primarily driven by the fact that the personalist style of rule that he was trying to pursue didn't work well, didn't necessarily generate large turnout rates in elections seasons, which is something that he was evidently very interested in. And he had to adjust. But at the same time, every time he makes an adjustment, at least on that political front, he tends to retreat. For instance, you know, even though he elevated the role of Mustaqbal Watan, he tried to rely more heavily on political parties in, you know, starting from the 2020 elections, which was a very different approach to electoral engineering from the 2015 parliamentary elections. Even if he started incorporating a greater role for political parties, he's still very reluctant about adopting that ruling party system of rule. And therefore, he's been extremely reluctant about recognizing what Mustaqbal Watan Party has been doing for him since basically since 2020, which is act as his ruling party. In fact, I would argue that Mustaqbal al-Watan has become his acting ruling party, but he's still reluctant to award it that official recognition, in large part because left to his own devices, I think Sisi would like to rule over Egypt based on his own personalist style of rule, as opposed to relying on political institutions and political parties.
In a clear example of his preference for that personalist style of rule is a quote from 2016, in which he says, "If you truly love Egypt, listen to my words only, only mine." And so, you know, it's you can't put it in any more clear terms than that. Now, you'd also noted that he's inspired to some degree by the bling of the Gulf Arab states and how inapplicable that model is to Egypt, which is a much larger society and obviously faces greater challenges in terms of feeding and employing a much larger population. And so this economic model, this model of growth that isn't a good fit for Egypt, represents a real squandered opportunity, because this idea of investing in a what is ultimately a bureaucratic city and devoting or taking out so much debt to build this, you know, an area that will not really produce greater productivity, at least directly and in the short term, on its own, because it's not geared towards commerce, is really nonsensical and reflects how poor choices are made in these patrimonial authoritarian systems, because there are no real countervailing forces, because they're either locked up or too afraid. Now, I'm wondering, in terms of shaping the behavior of Sisi, what is the role of the United States? Egypt has been among the top recipients of U.S. economic and military aid since the 1979 Camp David Accords. We did see the Washington use aid as a form of leverage to some degree after the 2013 coup, when the Obama administration suspended aid to Egypt or military aid to Egypt, but it was resumed in 2015 as threats from ISIS militants grew. And then we've seen in some years some calls for conditioning aid to Egypt, but the White House continues to make use of waivers. So I'm wondering, in your view, is the United States using its leverage to produce a more free and democratic Egypt? And is the U.S. doing enough to support Egypt's Democrats?
Well, I would contend with the assumption that there is, in fact, or has been, in fact, a democracy policy pursued in relationship, not just to Egypt, but towards the Middle East at large by any recent U.S. administration. I mean, the name of the game since 2013 has been, at least from successive U.S. administrations, has been thoughts and prayers, right? So the military coup happens in Egypt, and despite the measures that you just mentioned, you know, Secretary of State John Kerry came out and basically said that the military was resetting democracy in Egypt not long after it had committed large-scale massacre against supporters of the ousted president. And I think this is extremely important to remember, because there is this narrative that the political or politics in Egypt became authoritarian because of the Trump administration. And I think this is only a half-truth, because the transgressions against the democratizing process that, or attempts at advancing more political openness and participation and competition in Egypt after 2011, the backlash against this actually started under the Obama administration. As a matter of fact, I would argue that the backlash against this and many other countries that experienced some political openness in the wake of the Arab uprisings in 2011 was well underway under the Obama administration. Obviously, there is something to be said about Trump's embrace, friendly embrace of autocrats, and
you know, all of the, I mean, the spectacle of bromance between Trump and Sisi were no secret to anyone. And, you know, he was quoted as actually calling him his favorite dictator. You know, I think it did speak to this idea that in some ways the Trump administration openly embraced these autocratic practices. And under the Biden administration, at least, you know, in lead up or then presidential candidate Joe Biden, in the lead up to the 2020 election, there were signs and statements that were made and tweets that were made that he would no longer give blank checks to Trump's favorite dictators like Abdel-Fattah el-Sisi and possibly even like MBS, but that never went anywhere. I think ultimately, even if that warm, the spectacle of the warm embrace that the Trump administration, you know, created in relationship to these autocrats, be it Abdel-Fattah el-Sisi or other autocrats in the region, even if it wasn't there under the Biden administration, the policy is still ultimately the same, which is a policy that has not supported democracy or has not supported pro-democracy forces in any shape or form. There has been consistent clampdown against political opposition, against free expression of political views in Egypt. But we never saw meaningful action or even serious statements coming from the administration. There has been large communities of political activists who have been behind bars for over a decade now in Egypt, and there hasn't been any meaningful movement on that front, and there hasn't been any evidence of meaningful pressure coming from any president, any, you know, of the three presidents who've served during that period, be it President Obama or President Trump or President Biden. So in certain respects, the outcome is still the same, which is, you know, a situation where policy is reinforcing and openly supporting authoritarian stability in Egypt for the obvious reasons that U.S. policy is aimed at securing, you know, a set of geostrategic interests in relationship to Egypt and in relationship to the, you know, in relation to the region at large. And I don't think that that has changed much over the course of the past 10 years, despite some minor changes in the aesthetics from one administration to the other.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the outputs, they're very, very similar, if not identical in many ways. And I think in terms of the broader political discourse, you know, there's a tendency to treat the Trump era as a complete departure in terms of how the United States engaged with the world. But for example, if we look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, I'm not sure what else the Trump administration can do to what path the Trump administration would pursue that would be any different from what President Biden is doing. And the Biden campaign said that it would come to power putting democracy and human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. But as we've seen, not just in Egypt, but in many other parts of the world, it is the security interests and what are perceived as the broader strategic interests of the United States that take precedence over, you know, the question of democracy, even in a country as large as Egypt. And so for, you know, the average Egyptian who seeks a more free and democratic polity, I think it makes little sense to put their hopes in the United States. One arm of the U.S. government may, for example, support electoral transparency and give a grant to some kind of electoral watchdog organization in Cairo and give them $250,000 for 1 year or something like that. But then ultimately, you know, the president of the United States decides to give a waiver to the authoritarian ruler of that country. And so in the larger sum, those little crumbs that are fed to pro-democracy elements do not change the broader picture when it comes to governance and freedom in countries like Egypt. Now, final question. Where do you see Egypt going in the next 5 to 10 years? Is the Assisi model sustainable? You know, you've talked about ways it has adapted and even in sort of in a pendulum-like pattern where it moves from this personalist model to one that is a bit more corporatist and then goes back to the personalist model. So there is this kind of adaptivity, if not ambivalence. So I'm wondering, in your view, do you regard this model as sustainable given the economic challenges that Egypt is facing?
As you know, I'm a creature of DC, and whenever I'm asked to make predictions about the future, I've been socialized and trained to always make non-falsifiable statements when asked to make any type of projection. Things like, you know, the next 6 to 12 months are going to be very critical or something along those lines. But to your question, I think, you know, there's so much uncertainty about what is going to happen in Egypt in the aftermath of the presidential elections. You know, the country's economy has deteriorated in unprecedented ways. The prices have been skyrocketing to levels that haven't been seen, you know, haven't been experienced by different multiple generations of Egyptians. One of the biggest reasons why this election is actually happening in 2023 and not in 2024 as it was anticipated is because the state is expected to embark on a set of very destabilizing economic policies that will include possibly, you know, currency devaluations, further subsidy cuts, measures that are likely going to generate a great deal of political and socioeconomic discontent. The story of this regime for the past 10 years has been the story of pursuing a set of economic policies or pursuing a very exclusionary economic path that undermines longstanding economic and social rights in Egypt, that undermines the longstanding social pact that has existed in Egypt since the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser. And I think this exclusionary economic path is very much predicated on the closure of political space through violence, through politically motivated prosecutions, through imprisonments, through the outlawing of dissent, through the crushing of political life and civil society, through the control of independent media or once independent media and not so independent anymore. And, you know, so that is to say that I do think it's fair to say that the regime is betting on repression. It's betting on the fact that despite the heavy economic costs that many segments of the Egyptian population will have to suffer in the wake of these prospective contentious economic policies it's about to adopt, that ultimately the use of repression will maintain the stability of the regime. And once you bet on repression, I think this is something that always lends itself to uncertainties, right? Because we have experienced a moment in time where most observers thought of Egypt's repressive apparatus under Hosni Mubarak as very robust, that it doesn't miss a beat, that it's, you know, a strong and very fierce repressive apparatus that you can't defeat. But ultimately, it was defeated. And those things actually lend themselves to a lot of unpredictability. And I would say that when it comes to the question of popular anger, when it comes to spontaneous mobilizations around social and economic discontent, this is a wild card that we can't predict. But ultimately, if the bet is always on repression, or if the regime's bet is always on repression, there isn't always a guarantee that it will actually work. Particularly if we're talking about a period of time that will not only witness a great deal of economic, socioeconomic anger,
But also we're talking about a period of time where the war, this seemingly, you know, prolonged war in Gaza, and will likely also create a great deal of popular anger, and has been creating a great deal of popular anger inside of Egyptian society. And I think any sort of signals that the Egyptian government or that the Sisi regime will do anything to that will, you know, support the Israel's plans to force another wave of dispossession and displacement on the Palestinian people. If there is any sort of indication that the Sisi regime would okay or would tacitly endorse such policy, as has been circulating in media reports and evidently in policy circles, I think it does lend itself to a lot of uncertainty. It lends itself to a reality in which popular anger could, in fact, shake this seemingly robust political stability that we have seen over the past decade.
Yeah, and I think when you look at inflation in particular, even in the United States, you know, we saw inflation here hit around 10%, and that has really impacted public support for President Joe Biden. Former President Trump continues to lead him in the polls, and despite the fact that the U.S. has avoided a recession, the job market is quite healthy. The fact that inflation went so high, at least in the U.S. sense, has had a lingering effect on people because it directly impacts their purchasing power. Now, in Egypt, it's somewhere around 40%, and Egyptians have faced double-digit inflation for many years. And so that's bound to have some kind of impact on the general public and in terms of their political attitudes. And there's no real indication that there is an immediate way out for Egypt. If you look at, you talked about how Assisi favors an Gulf Arab style model. They want him to change the way he's economic policy, and they want the Egyptian military to divest from the economy. And they don't want to compete with Egyptian military actors that receive preferences in terms of policymaking in this distorted economic environment, in this distorted market. In terms of the economic situation, there's not much that is really, you know, positive in terms of the future for Egypt, in, at least in the short term.
If you've gotten to a point where the economic situation has deteriorated so much that your Gulf allies, who are not exactly known for, you know, spending inhibitions, are actually staging an intervention to tell you spend less and spend more responsibly, that tells you that things have gotten really bad. But also the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, what we don't know how this is going to play out over the course of the next year on the economic front. We're not sure if the IMF and the creditors are going to budge on questions of contentious and destabilizing economic reforms that are being demanded of Egypt. But I think what we do know is that Sisi has not exactly been the most diplomatic politicians when it comes to justifying contentious and socially destabilizing economic policies. I think what makes Sisi stand out among his predecessors is his dropping all pretensions about the state's alleged commitment to social equity and distributive justice. You know, the previous governments or the previous leaders have always tried to convince people that they have not abandoned, you know, the Gamal Abdel Nasser's path to social justice and to protecting the social and economic rights that were enshrined during the era of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Even if they were in practice completely undermining the foundations of, you know, that system or these rights through their economic liberalization schemes. They were trying to hide from the public
the fact that, you know, their economic liberalization policies were in fact undermining things like distributive justice and social and economic rights. Sisi, on the other hand, is not interested in doing this anymore. He approaches, you know, at least his public speaking on questions of economic policies has been less cautious and much less diplomatic than his predecessors. For example, he often scolds the public, just like a general would scold and discipline his soldiers, whenever there is any hint of public grumbling about economic policies. When economic conditions become dire, especially for middle or low-income households, the president usually presses them to just live with it and just reminds them that he never promised them a rose garden. He's unapologetic about rising prices. He's unapologetic about harsh austerity. And he never tries to sugarcoat unpopular economic policies. So this is something that we definitely have to keep in mind as we're thinking about how the economic situation or the deteriorating economic situation will affect political stability in Egypt in the coming years.
So it looks really uncertain. You know, the economic situation is the big wild card, as well as the unfolding war in Israel and Palestine, and many of the outside actors that directly or indirectly support Egypt economically could decide that it's too big to fail, and then it is benefits from their largesse. Well, thank you, Hisham. I think we'll close on that note, and it was great to have you on. And it was also great to catch up. We should do this again in the future.
Yes, we absolutely should. Thank you so much, Arif.
And that was Hisham Saddam of Stanford University. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.